Our protection will come to order. It is Tuesday, March 31st, 2009, and we have a full agenda. Members, we're trying to get everything done between today and Thursday and hopefully not have to meet next Tuesday, but if some things don't get finished, that's what they'll end up being on Tuesday, a week from today. So, Senator Pappas, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's lovely to be back in front of the Commerce Committee again. And I have on Senate File 518, I have two author's amendments, the A1, delete all amendment, and then the A2 is a result of further negotiations with some folks in the industry.
Okay, and do we have a quorum? Not yet. We don't have a quorum yet,
okay.
So we'll...
Okay, Madam Chair, we could start our presentation.
I think it would be fine. We do. We now have a quorum. So Senator Pappas would like, Senator Metzen, would you offer the A1 delete everything amendment to put the bill in the shape that Senator Pappas would like to discuss it?
So moved.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. There you go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then would you add the A2 amendment also?
So moved.
You know, did I say A1 or A2?
We have two.
I did
we have
say
an A1,
A1
and
was,
we have an A2.
And forgive me, I was looking at the A2 when I said it. So Senator Metzen will move the A2 amendment. And it amends the delete everything amendment I'm seeing.
That's right.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Okay, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This legislation is an effort to curb debt settlement abuse. There are more than 1,000 debt settlement companies doing business in the United States, an increase of more than 300% from just a few years ago. Debt settlers promise to negotiate with creditors to settle for cents on the dollar. The Federal Trade Commission has had numerous complaints and taken enforcement actions against many debt settlement companies. Debt settlers often advise consumers to stop paying their debts and instead, over a 2 to 3 year period, accumulate money in a savings account to pay off debts at cents on the dollar. The debt settlers claim that if the consumer doesn't pay for several years, creditors will be more willing to settle at a significantly lower amount than what is actually owed. In a 2008 hearing, the FTC identified many shady and abusive business practices, including telling consumers to stop paying creditors, making misleading and erroneous claims, failing to provide services after receiving fees, failing to make disclosures like your credit will become worse, for example, or two, interest and penalties will continue to accrue, or wages and bank accounts can be garnished, collectors can still call you, the consumer can still be sued, and if any part of the debt is forgiven, that has to be reported as income to the IRS, and finally, charging excessive fees. Debt settlement is completely unregulated in Minnesota. There are a number of states that ban for-profit debt settlement and make the provision of debt settlement services by for-profit a crime. This bill does not outlaw all debt settlement services. What it does is it requires that all debt settlers be registered with the Minnesota Department of Commerce. It prohibits false and misleading promises and abusive business practices, and it establishes additional consumer protections to prevent abuse. Minnesota passed similar legislation 2 years ago to regulate debt management companies. Their mission, unlike debt settlers, is to help consumers actually repay their debt. Dozens of companies have registered, and the legislation has been effective in allowing legitimate businesses to operate while curbing the abuses of the unscrupulous ones. This legislation was brought to me by Legal Aid, and you all are very familiar with Mr. Ron Elwood. But he's worked very hard over the last couple months, and we can now claim our supporter list to include the Minnesota Bankers Association, the Minnesota Credit Union Network, Independent Bankers, Minnesota Collectors Association, the Attorney General, who's represented here by Jeffrey Harrington, Lutheran Social Services, Community Action Partnership, U.S. Bank, and, of course, Legal Aid. Madam Chair, with that introduction, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Elwood, who can walk members through the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Pappas. Mr. Elwood, welcome. And also, I don't know if Senator Pappas did. I was distracted for a few seconds here. If she distinguished between debt management and debt settlement, because did you do that? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay. So everybody knows
Debt management difference. Helps people pay their bills, and debt settlers help people settle for less.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair, thank you, and members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. And just to elaborate a little bit on the differences between the two, and of course, the chair should be very familiar with the debt management provision since she carried the bill 2 years ago. And as many of you will know or recall from that that those hearings, the debt management approach is where a group like Lutheran Social Services will essentially manage people's finances monthly. They will take the monthly sum of money that the debtor will send to them, and then in turn divvy that up among the creditors. They will have negotiated a repayment plan with each of the creditors, and the debtor will send one lump sum to Lutheran Social Services, and each month Lutheran Social Services will turn around and pay the monthly payment. Debt settlement is a very, very, very different animal. With debt settlement, there really is no contact between the debtor or the debtor's representative, the debt settlement company, and the creditor for sometimes as much as 3 or 4 years. And in the interim, the debtor is supposed to put away enough money to get to a point where they would theoretically have enough leverage to convince the creditor to settle at less than what is owed. So in a debt management situation, you are essentially each time you're making those monthly payments, while both in debt settlement, debt management, the credit is not so good going in, the debt management approach is really a step in the direction of repairing the credit because you're starting to make payments on a regular basis. In a debt settlement situation, you're actually worsening your credit because you're not making any payments, and then at the end of the day, you're paying not repaying the debt, but paying less than you owe. So with that, the bill I will briefly walk you through, the delete all of the beginning sections all the way up until the bottom of page 11 makes some changes to our existing debt management law to kind of conform it to some of the changes we made in the debt settlement provisions, adding some additional consumer protections that are applicable. I should mention that we have spoken with Lutheran Social Services and the other debt management companies, our Minnesota companies, and they are very supportive of these changes. So the guts of the bill really starts on page 11. And we define what a debt settlement service company is and what they do on page 12. That's in subdivision 7 on line 12.17. And I just described what they are, so this just essentially codifies that.
And excuse me, Mr. Elwood, just one. Senator Olson, I don't know if anybody else, we're working off the delete everything amendment, which
the A one.
Probably. I just happened to see that you had that. So, and other members, yeah. So, carry on, Senator, Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. So, beginning on page 13, on line 13.12, begin the registration requirements. We did the exact same thing with debt management companies. There are dozens of companies here operating in Minnesota, legitimately registered with Commerce, paying the fees, and complying with the law. So all the registration sections dealing with the applications, what has to be in the application, what the rights of appeal on denial and suspension and all that, they go all the way up to page 15. And the bottom of page 15, section 21, begins the provisions that are applicable to the debt settlement companies in terms of their contracts. And this would require, as we do with debt management, a written contract. It describes what the kinds of things that must be in the contract. And I would point out on page 16, line 6, one of the things that needs to be on the contract and also disclosed in any communications is whether or not this business is registered with the Department of Commerce. I would point out also on line 16.9 that the contract and also later on the disclosures must be provided in the language of the debtor if the business advertises in that language. So it's not saying you have to have every language in the world, but if you're going to advertise in that language, the contract and the disclosures need to be in that language. Subdivision 2, beginning on line 16.13, provides some preliminary requirements before a contract can be executed. And among those are that the debt settlement provider must make a determination with whether this is a suitable intervention, a debt repayment intervention, and whether the debtor can actually meet the terms of the contract. Starting on line 16.30 are the disclosures, and as Senator Pappas talked about, it essentially tells folks what we have learned from the Federal Trade Commission and the Minnesota Attorney General's office. Many of these settlers do not tell people some of the problems that they could encounter with continuing to be getting collector's calls, being garnished, being sued, and all those things that can still happen while this program is in place. So it tells them up front what they can expect. Moving on to page 18 and starting in line 18.21, provides the right to cancel. I would point out that as we have done in the debt management law, we provide either party the right to cancel. So if the the debtor can cancel if they're feeling they're not getting the services, all the money that hasn't already been sent to creditors goes back to the debtor. And the debt settlement company, for cause, can cancel as well. So if the debtor is not keeping up with the debtor's part of the bargain, then that would be cause for cancellation. Moving on to page 20, the next critical piece are the fees. And what we do in this provision, and this I would point out, is the most controversial part of the bill for the industry. And they will likely hear about that from them.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, I just, on that section, I've been looking at it. if I settle, somebody owes, the consumer owes $20,000 and I somehow get it way down to $10,000 for the consumer, and it's probably taken me a year and a half to get it, you know, to handle it, to get it down. I could only get $500. Is that correct?
Well, it would be $550. It would be $550 under the current bill. I would like to mention.
Why would I do that? All that work for? And if I'm a consumer, I'd be tickled pink to get it knocked down a whole $10,000. You know. And if you're going to do all this work and only get $500, maybe it would fence some people out of the business.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Senator Metzen, I have two responses for that. First of all, what the debt management people are doing as opposed to these guys.
This is a debt settlement.
Yes, I'm saying what the debt management people, every month they're handling people's money and sending it to the creditors. They're doing a lot of work every month. On the debt settlement side, essentially there's the initial contract and setting up the person, and then they're really not making contact with the creditor for 3 years. So one of the things that I heard when I was in Washington at that FTC workshop was a lot of questions from the commission and others as to what exactly are the folks in the industry doing for the 3 years while the folks are putting the money away to give them a lot of settlements. So I think that's where the apples and oranges come in. There's not a whole lot of action going on in the interim. So the fees seem to be somewhat commensurate. However, I will point out that we have been in discussions with one of the two trade organizations, the United States Organizations for Bankruptcy Alternatives, whom you'll hear from in a little while. And we've essentially resolved all of the issues. The A2 amendment actually reflects a lot of those discussions that we've had over the last week and resolves virtually everything other than the fee issue, which they still, as you've pointed out, they feel that it's just insufficient for them the way we've structured it. I have just last week provided some alternative approach, and we are continuing to work on that issue to perhaps make it a little easier for them to operate.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is somewhat the same question that Senator Metzen asked. Mr. Elwood, how would this affect if I called my own personal attorney and I asked him to settle something for me and we decided on amount between us? How would that affect that relationship? I don't want to have to make a contract just to have this one issue taken care of.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, attorneys are exempt from this bill. It wouldn't affect it at all.
So an attorney, I was going to ask the same question, Senator Johnson, but I assumed that they were exempt from this and it would not be regulated by the department. The people that I know that have entered into debt settlement have done it through an attorney.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
My question then is, who does this bill affect?
Mr. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, there is an industry out there operating. There are, according to the FTC, over 1,000 companies that are private sector, private enterprises that are debt settlement companies. This is an animal that has emerged over the last 6-7 years or a little more. It's a fairly new kind of an enterprise, and it's in response to the growing debt crisis in the country.
And I think, Senator Johnson, that you don't hear them in the advertising, but there's a considerable amount of advertising right now, particularly on the radio, frankly, even on Air America, for debt settlement services, which I found interesting.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Johnson, I bet you don't listen to it.
You're probably you're all here pretty late at night, so you probably don't get to watch a lot of cable TV. But if you did, you'd see these over and over and over and over again.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Elwood. I just have a couple comments about sort of in response to what Senator Metzen said, but in terms of the overall public policy, it seems to me that making these fees as limited as we can is and having some controls on that is good public policy, because what these settlement companies are doing is they're essentially telling people not to pay their bills, from what I'm hearing, which I don't think is a public policy that we want to encourage. It's hurting people's credit, which is, again, of real concern in difficult times like this. The businesses and who are owed the money are not going to be receiving the payments they would have received. And it sounds like there's a lot of abuses in terms of taking advantage of people in kind of a desperate situation, and then getting kind of having this upfront middleman taking money out of the system that could have been directed at least toward helping to reduce the payment of those bills. So in terms of a method to address, when we have bankruptcy and we have other avenues for people who can't pay bills, but to just take more of the money off the table is probably not a good public policy. So, you know, I was looking at this and saying, why do we even allow this to happen? But, you know, maybe there is a purpose for it, but I certainly think it should be regulated so that consumers aren't taken advantage of. And then the only other comment I was going to make is when I was looking at the prohibition section where you talk about, you know, that they can't tell people, this is on page 21. It says no debt settlement services providers shall, and then it says things like imply or infer that this is going to help with credit, or that their wages or bank accounts are not subject to garnishment. What I was thinking is that it might be better to frame this in the form of a positive and make it a requirement that the person entering into the agreement will be informed of these things.
It's on the warning.
Because if they just simply stay silent, there could be a misconception that, those things won't be happening.
Mr. Elwood, isn't there some language that talks about what you must do in the contract? Is that?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I think you might have come in just a bit late.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And there's a required disclosure
page 16,
that covers those things, and here's those things you must say, and this just essentially says if you misrepresent those things, then it's a subject, it's a claim that can be made under the remedies.
Madam Chair, why don't we turn to my other witness,
okay.
Mr. Harrington from the Attorney General's Office.
Welcome, Mr. Harrington.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Harrington. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. Thank you for conducting this hearing on this very important issue of debt settlement companies. The Attorney General's Office has worked with Senator Pappas and Ron Elwood and others on this bill, and the Office of the Minnesota Attorney General does support this bill. Many consumers who are dealing with the tough economic times turn to debt settlement service providers for help. However, there are problems with this industry. For example, consumers are sometimes charged stiff upfront fees, but the debt settlement provider doesn't come through with services. Consumers are sometimes advised to stop paying their creditors, but they're not told that they will incur late fees, higher interest, and may be sued in court. Also, consumers are sometimes confused about whether the debt settlement provider will be actually paying their creditors when they are not. This bill provides many common sense protections for consumers. For example, as been mentioned, the bill requires written signed contracts. The bill places some common sense caps on fees, and it requires disclosures and certain warnings concerning accrual of interest, late fees, and that they may be sued. In sum, Madam Chair, the Attorney General's Office supports this bill. Thank you very much.
Mr. Harrington, thank you. Any questions? I think that we have a Mr. Young here to testify in opposition.
Madam Chair,
Senator Johnson, just
a comment as he's coming to the table. I think preferably I'd rather be doing this to the credit companies saying, wait a minute, what about this 30% interest rate you're charging? What about these late fees? I don't know if this is, I'd like to do it up front instead of in reverse.
You're talking about with the credit card companies, which are banks, which are,
yeah.
It's tough for us to get our hands on them, our laws on them. So, Mr. Young, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Madam Chair, Honorable Committee, my name is Wesley Young, and I'm here on behalf of the Association of Settlement Companies, which I'll refer to as TASC, T-A-S-C. We're a national association. We represent about 190 debt settlement companies, including one here in the St. Paul, Minneapolis area. What my association does is we actually support consumer protections. We support good business practices for the industry. We are a self-regulating entity. We have a third-party secret shopper that we hire to pose as a consumer and shop each one of our members to make sure that they are compliant and that they are abiding by our standards, some of which are include all of the disclosures that Senator Pappas has mentioned that she was concerned about consumers not knowing, some of the things that the Attorney General mentioned, that Attorney General's office mentioned that he was concerned about that we were not telling consumers. These are all in our standards, and we enforce them. And if our members do not abide by our standards, their membership will be revoked. So I am testifying in opposition, but I do applaud Representative Davenport in the House and Senator Pappas for wanting to regulate our industry. We want to regulate our industry as well. The problem is that this bill doesn't just regulate us. It puts us out of business. We wish that Senator Pappas and Representative Davenport had come to us, the industry, since we regulate ourselves, come to us to ask us for some language that would properly regulate our industry. Let me take a step back and explain to you the importance of why we are needed and why this, I think one of the committee members had asked, when did this all get started? And it started about 5 or 6 years ago. Really, the explosion in the industry coincided with the change in bankruptcy laws. In 2005, Congress enacted the Bankruptcy Reform Act, making it much more difficult for consumers to qualify for bankruptcy. On the other hand, while consumer credit counseling does provide a valuable service, I was at a hearing in Oregon where a nonprofit credit counselor testified that the best interest rate that she could get for her clients was 16%. So under credit counseling, you have to pay back 100% of your debt at 16% interest per annum, accelerated into a five-year plan. So between bankruptcy and credit counseling, there's this big gap of people who can't afford credit counseling or don't qualify for bankruptcy. And academics, even the FTC, consumer groups, agree that there's a large subset of consumers who cannot pay back their debt unless they receive some concession, not just in the interest rate, but in the principal itself. And that's what we do.
Mr. Young, I don't want to cut you short. I think I understand what you're saying. Could you speak to – it sounded like – I thought you were going to support the bill when you talked about some of the elements of Senator Pappas's bill being similar or the same as what you – the standards you have for the association. But you said it would put you out of business. I think the committee members would like to hear
sure, let me give
why
you
that would happen. I assume it's got to do with the fee, but – maybe it's more than that. I don't know.
It is the fee. The fee is obviously the elephant in the room.
Okay.
But there are other issues. Let me give you an example. I think that really puts some meat to this. Taking a $20,000 debt, if we were to reduce that debt, a debt settlement company were to reduce that debt by $10,000, so they save the consumer at least $10,000, the fee that we could collect would be $500, as was mentioned previously. For that same $20,000 debt, if a consumer went to a credit counselor, that consumer would pay the $20,000 principal at 16% interest over 5 years. That would be $9,181 in interest. Credit counselors can charge 15% of the monthly payment that the consumer makes. So in paying back $29,000 of debt, the consumer credit counseling company can charge $4,377 over those 5 years. $500, $4,377. In addition, the credit counselors are funded by credit card companies. Mm-hmm. And I'm being conservative. I know that they used to pay more, but I'm estimating if they pay even an 8% fair share, which is every payment that the consumer makes, they take a cut of it. 8% would be $2,000 on that $20,000 debt with the $9,000 of interest, $2,334.48. So the credit counselor is able to collect in fees from both the consumer and the creditor $6,711.48. Again, the debt settlement company can collect $500 for 3 years of work. The other thing I wanted to address, too, was I think one of the questions or that Mr. Elwood mentioned was regarding the work that debt settlement companies do, and that he had heard that the debt settlement companies don't do anything for 3 years and then just settle at the end, whereas the credit counselors do work all in the interim. We have done a study comparing debt settlement companies to credit counseling companies, and at least the companies that are doing it right are staffed 10 times the level that a credit counseling company is. The reason for that is once the plan in a credit counseling plan is set up, it's a monthly payment system. I mean, we can do this electronically. The consumer makes a payment to the provider. The provider splits that up among the creditors. That can be all done by an automated system. We don't have, as debt settlement companies, any prearranged agreements with the creditors. We require, let's say a consumer has that $20,000 debt, maybe made up of six or seven accounts. We have to track where that debt is, because these debts don't stay with just Bank of America or Citibank. They go on to a collection agency. They may go to three or four collection agencies. They may be sold to a third-party debt buyer who then hires another three or four collection agencies to try and collect on that debt. We have to keep up with how much it is. We have to educate our consumers and keep them accountable. A lot of times what I do is the comparison I make is like, if you're working out at a gym or you're on a diet plan and you need someone to hold your hand and get you through that, we set up our consumers on a budget to follow to save money to settle their debt. But these are people who've struggled a lot of times with discipline in their finances. So we need to make sure that they are staying on budget, that they're setting their money aside in savings. And many of the good companies, for instance, companies in my association, call the the consumers monthly, if not more often than that, to check and make sure that they are staying on budget. And then the negotiating process is often a very lengthy process. We may start negotiating with one collection agency and maybe not settle the debt until it gets to the third or fourth collection agency. So our work is very work intensive, very personnel intensive. So our costs are greater than, we believe, are greater than the credit counseling company's costs. The other problem that we have with the bill is some of the disclosure requirements. Not that we have a problem with the disclosures themselves or making disclosures. The manner in which they are drafted, I know that there's warning labels on cigarette packages. You know, warning can cause death. This is worded very similar to a collection letter that our clients get from creditors. It's worded very strongly. It says you should pay back your debts, regardless of what circumstance the consumer is in. It doesn't take into consideration the fact that they may have just lost their job. They may be trying to choose between paying their credit card bill or paying their house. It doesn't take into consideration if they are in a negative amortization situation, which means that the debt is growing faster than they're able to make payments on, which is in, you've seen these, Congress has actually already addressed this some with the credit card abuses in the interest rates that are being charged at 30%, late fees and other charges that are being made. These consumers are falling behind on their debts.
Okay. Mr. Young, Senator Scogin has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, two, if you'd allow. We heard early statements or testimony that you're completely unregulated, Mr. Young. Is that in Minnesota? Is that a true statement?
We are. Yes, Madam Chair, Senator, we are at this point in time in Minnesota unregulated. Now, we did attempt 2 years ago to introduce some legislation that was, I think, even lengthier than this bill here to regulate us. But at that time, we were not able to reach an agreement with legal aid on the fees. And so at this time, we are unregulated from a law perspective. Now, again, my association, we do provide extensive self-regulation of our members.
And Senator Scogin.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just would be curious what other states do with fees where you are regulated.
Madam Chair, Mr. Senator, in Colorado and Delaware, the fees are 18% of the amount of debt that is enrolled at the time of they start the program. In Idaho, the fee is 20% of the amount of debt enrolled. In Utah, a bill just passed and was signed by the governor about 6 days ago that's formed a two-tier fee structure, a flat fee, which is 17%, has a 17% cap, or a savings fee model, which is a 20% cap. So those are, and there's other bills that we expect to get passed this year that have similar caps.
Madam Chair, one
Senator
more.
Scogin.
Are there any with a specific dollar amount?
Mr. Young.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Madam Chair, I'd
yes,
like,
Senator Pappas.
If we could, I'd like Mr. Elwood to respond
yes.
to some of Mr. Young's comments.
Right, and we do want to keep moving, so we'll make it quick. But
Madam Chair, I'll be quick. First of all, I would suggest that self-regulation really hasn't worked too well in the debt management arena, and that's why we regulated them in the same manner that we're trying to regulate the debt settlement. It hasn't worked all that great in other financial transactions most recently. Second of all, TASC has not come to us. In fact, the other association, whom you heard from, USOBA, has come to us, and in fact, all these amendments are the product of our work with USOBA. So that is false. The other, when the issue of who can pay and who can't afford it, the contracts that we have seen from here, for example, one provides that $800 per month is put into this savings account for 3 years. So my question is, if a consumer can put $800 into a savings account each month and keep it there for 3 or 4 years, my calculations would be after 3 years, they'd have accumulated $28,800. If you take the fee model that we've just heard at 20%, of the principal of the debt at, say, a $30,000 debt, that would be $6,000 in fees. Subtracted from that $28,000, that's significant. And the way the fee structures work with these debt settlement companies, they take all their fees up front. So I saw a contract where there was a $13,000 debt, and after 3 years, after putting away $800 a month for 3 years, there was $2,000 in that account towards the settlement because the rest had been extracted up front for fees. You heard about all the work they do in the interim. I'm not so sure, frankly, that there's thousands of dollars in fees are required for personal training or coaching to keep people on track. And as far as tracking the debts, I would assume that the consumers sure know where their debts are and who owns them because they're getting called and they're getting written to by the creditors asking for the money. And finally, the question about the disclosures regarding warning people that they shouldn't stop paying their debts. We actually have modified that in negotiations with the USOBA folks, and if you'll see on the A2 amendment on page 2, lines 28 and 29, we have modified that to talk about what could possibly happen if you do stop paying your debts rather than to say, you know, don't do that. So we've worked very closely with these other folks in trying to make this thing work for the legitimate debt settlement companies.
Madam Chairman.
Then we're not going to go back and forth a whole lot.
Madam Chair, I think there's someone else who wants to testify.
Yes, there is. Ms. June, did you have something quick to say?
Very briefly in closing, we are supportive of regulation of our industry, but this regulation here puts us out of business. We think Minnesota consumers need more choices now. They don't need fewer choices. They need more choices in helping them deal with their debt. They need an advocate for them, not someone that's being paid by the creditors. And we just ask for fair regulation of our industry. And we're willing to participate in that process.
Yeah, thank you. And I understand there is someone else who would like to address the committee. Line up there. Welcome. I just need you to identify yourself and you may speak to the committee.
Madam Chair, I'm a little nervous today. I'm not a professional testifier. I'm not an attorney. I do work with USOBA, which is the United States Organization of Bankruptcy Alternatives. I'm on their legislative committee, and my name is Al Leffler.
And I also, how do you spell that?
L-E-F-F-L-E-R. I'm also the owner of a debt settlement room in Mendota Heights. We have about 40 employees there. And I wanted to testify optimistically in opposition of the bill. Mr. Elwood has really worked hard with us, and he's been very supportive, and he's a true consumerist trying to protect consumer, and we're on the same page with him. But when we came to the fees, and I want to address one other thing. The clients that we have are basically in the Niagara River. They're going over the falls. They're not at bankruptcy yet, but they're headed that way. People that can pay their bills ought to pay their bills. Our average client has a credit score of somewhere between 450 and 580 now. We are not taking people that should be paying their bills, that can afford to pay their bills. We're taking those people that have too much month left at the end of the money. They have been paying and paying, and since the mortgage industry has not made the can't take the money from the subprime people anymore, guess where they've taken it? They've moved it to credit cards. And our average rate now is around 27%. So these people are paying and paying and paying. They got the bumper sticker. It says, I owe, so off to work I go. And they're frankly sick and tired of being sick and tired. There's not enough mice in the house to blow the whole house up and declare bankruptcy, but they can't afford the payment that Consumer Credit Counseling is offering them. So we're just trying to figure out a way how to make this work. When I testified in the House side, and showed how our program worked, a gentleman contacted our office that was in support of a bill that came up next. $60,000 worth of credit card debt. He was a courier. He contacted our office and said, I can't afford the payment Consumer Credit Counseling has offered. I don't want to file bankruptcy. I need your help. Can you enroll me in your program? So we think we fit. It's like Neapolitan ice cream. There is a place for this, and we appreciate all the work Mr. Elwood has put in. We know we need regulation. We've heard some of the same ads that you have heard, and we're frankly embarrassed by them. They take business away from the legitimate ones. But when we look at, I also pulled up our Better Business Bureau report. We are a member of the Better Business Bureau. We have 12,000 clients over the last 3 years. We have zero unresolved complaints with the Better Business. So we're happy to report that. We're a good business. We try to do things right. People skip payments. We work with them. We do outbound calls to these people. And yet, people sometimes do quit halfway through, and they do owe more interest and things like that. But that's not untrue of any other financial product. So we're trying to do things right. We give liberal refunds, but we know that if the bill passed the way it is, there's 140 members of USOBA that would basically pull out of the state because we just couldn't afford to operate here. I would like to address one other thing. That is, again, our company has figured out that if we can do a settlement for a client in the first 3 or 4 months, let's say they have 5 credit cards, Madam Chair, and so if we can get one settled, maybe they got a small Capital One account, they all of a sudden believe that this will work. So we're trying to settle not all 5 of their credit cards at the end of 3 years. We're trying to settle them as soon as there's enough money to get one settled, and then the next one, and the next one. Because our data shows that less than 2% of our clients leave the program if they just see that it works. So we're trying to do things right away. We're trying to settle something to get something that shows, hey, if I stick with this, it'll work. And that's why we don't have the complaints. And we work with overwhelmed, stressed out people in denial who are scared to death, and it is a lot of work. And we have to – I gave you a copy of our contract here. This is what we send to every client. Very first thing is straight talk, things you need to know. This is a process that you need to be committed to. This is the way it works. This is one step back to take 2 steps forward. This is not credit repair. This is not going to be pleasant. This is surgery, but it's short of bankruptcy, and it'll help you get your life back for those who can't afford to make all their payments.
Mr. Loeffler, thank you. Mr. Elwood, I heard you say earlier that you were re-looking at the fee piece, and I can you elaborate on that? Because I'm thinking that, well, I really don't have a full sense of the committee, but I've heard a couple of people express concern about the fact that this might not be available at, you know, the fee that you have in the bill. I know the bill has to go to judiciary. I don't think it has to go anyplace else. We'd need to take care of this either today or Thursday.
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, several things. Yes, it needs to go to judiciary in the House. It went to those two committees and then to the floor. Actually, it went to the Finance Committee because there's actually a positive fiscal note on this bill. Couple of things on the fees. Just last week, I had sent a proposal over to the USOBA folks in Washington, with whom I'm dealing. I think Mr. Loeffler is sitting in for the main person who's been testifying in the House and with whom I'm working. And I proposed a slightly different structure, which would give them more money, kind of more operating capital while things are going on.
As you go along.
Yes.
Periodic,
yes,
payments, because I'm looking at the,
yes,
contract. That's what they do.
Yes. And it would be, it's a proposal that puts the fee structure into that framework. And also, but I think what's very important, and they are in agreement, is that the bulk of the fees should be received and collected when the work is done, when the settlement is done. So it's what we've done is to try to make it more fair so that people can keep going, and if they want to continue in the program, continue to do that and let the folks have some operating expenses. And then when the bulk of the work is done, like almost like anything else, when the in any contract, when the services are performed, that's when you get the bulk of the money. And I think, at least from my understanding, the USOBA folks are comfortable with that framework. We are certainly willing to work with the numbers within that to make it work for them. Because at least from our understanding, these are folks who legitimately want to do the right thing. And I can say to you that, again, I just want to emphasize that all these amendments and the amendments that are reflected in the delete all are products of our negotiations with these folks. We are actually down to just one thing, and we've made many, many, many moves in their direction. So I'm confident that we can make it work for the right people.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, it sounds like Mr. Elwood is a lot more willing to work with these groups and so forth. But I just have to say again, after having read this contract, I'm even more disturbed than the comments that I made before. And I'm assuming from the fact that you're here today at the legislature that you are one of the more reputable companies that, you know, and yet, as I read this, it looks to me like an attempt to convince someone. You put the language in there, but it's still, you're leading someone to say, don't pay your bills, let your credit get ruined, let your interest penalties and fees build up. You may get sued, although we're telling you probably most people won't sue you, but you may get sued. And do all of those things and take all of that risk with no guarantee of the outcome. And I just think that's really bad public policy. To put someone in that situation because they're desperate is incredible to me. And I understand the problems with the changes in the bankruptcy law, but it seems to me that maybe that's what we ought to be talking about and addressing, rather than encouraging people to go down this very risky, very damaging road. And I just think it's very disturbing that because these aren't – I understand that consumers are in a desperate situation, but is this a choice from a public policy standpoint that we really want to encourage? It seems to me like the person taking all the risks in this situation is the consumer, and that we ought to have some very tight regulations when we're putting someone in that kind of a really risky situation.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Olson has certainly articulated some of the issues, but we're trying to make a reasonable response to the concerns of an unregulated industry, and we do have two more stops. We'll continue to negotiate. So, Madam Chair, if someone would move the bill as amended and send us to judiciary, and then we will have to go to finance as well after that.
And anyway, just a comment.
Senator Metzen.
Just a comment on that. I don't think we should be moving not just this bill, but other bills out of this committee that deal with policy stuff and the hope that the judiciary that
which actually
would do things at that point. I think we ought to do things properly here, and if we need till Thursday to do that, I'm willing to wait. But I get tired of not so much this committee, but sometimes we move things out and say, well, you do it at the next step that does not have the jurisdiction that I think this committee should fix fix up the bills at this level.
And serving on the Judiciary Committee, I can say, I think with some assurance that I'm right, is that Senator Moi is not real keen on going into areas of the bill that are not within the jurisdiction. Senator Pappas, I don't know. I tend to agree with Senator Metzen. I'm not opposing your bill. I just think we need to work on that fee language, and I think it's an appropriate conversation in this committee. I don't know if somebody wants to move the bill. That's fine. I prefer that you continue to work out. We can't really just work it out now for the next hour and a half. I mean, that's in the committee. But don't know if there's a sense of other members that they feel that they would like to work on that. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to put on public record that I've never seen a contract like this before, and having read every word of it, I'm not in agreement with what Senator Olson has said about it. To me, it sounds like these people are in, again, really desperate situations, and the language is saying to them, it's a wake-up call. I'm sorry. Your credit's already ruined. We are going to help you if you stick with us. This is what they're going, you know, the creditors, like, again, going back to my other comment about the people that are charging the 30% interest rate, late fees, and all that other stuff, they're killing the people. And this, to me, is saying it's going to happen. Let's educate each other on this process. And there's a really comforting thing in here that says on number 6, your creditor may charge off your account, turn it over to a collection agency, or sell it. This is a normal part of the collection process and is not a cause for you to worry. To me, that's comfort language, because a lot of people don't realize what's going to happen, have no clue what they've gotten themselves into. And I see this language as maybe negative, maybe kind of positive, and I'd like to see more work done on the bill.
Members, what's the committee?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know how busy your agenda is.
Well, Senator Pappas,
I think we're fairly
confident
that we can work this out in before it gets to the floor. And we've worked on a lot of issues already in the bill. It's a very complicated bill. And you know, we understand we don't want to put legitimate businesses out of business.
Senator Pappas, I think the lion's share of the work is within the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee, so Commerce and Consumer Protection, and we care about that a lot here.
I think Mr. Leffler would like to comment on our negotiations.
Okay, Senator Pappas, I think that's fine. I just think that we need to have the conversation in this committee, and we do have time. I mean, we'll put you on the agenda Thursday. I know you have to be out of here by Thursday. You have to be through Judiciary and then to Finance. Is that...
When's our Judiciary hearing? We have to meet Judiciary by the deadline.
Right, but we have till what, next Tuesday, I think, for that. And and Senator Moi is not adverse to keeping us there for a long time to get through the bills. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to lay the bill over and ask you and promise you that we will very briefly on Thursday deal with your bill first. Okay? Because you did, I mean, I think you had a really fine presentation, and I think you went through the bill. Some members understand what's in it. I think we know what the stumbling block is, the main stumbling block, and that's the one I think members have the most concern about. So I'm going to do that. Thank you. Thank everybody for being here. I've just laid that over. We will hear it first on Thursday. And Senator Bach, as Senate File 528. Members, I'd have continued with us trying to work that out if it was something. It just seems like it's something that needs to be negotiated among the parties and not us.
Did we tell her specifically the fees part, or isn't that
Yes. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I too have a bill that's not totally worked out yet, but not sure it's going to get worked out in this committee. Probably that work is probably needed in the Judiciary Committee. But first, let me say, I promised myself, considering what the legislature was facing this year, that I was going to try and avoid bills that took a lot of work, because I have quite a bit of work to do in the Tax Committee. So most of what I've done has been constituent-driven stuff. It's been relatively small. But I did find myself with this bill and one other one that you members of the committee are pretty well aware of, because there's been quite a deal of lobbying been going on relative to this bill. I hope that the information you members have been receiving has been accurate. And I'd like to thank Senator Olson, Marty, Sparks, and Johnson for co-authoring this with me. I'm not sure I have another bill. Most time members don't want to author my tax bills that I introduce, so it's kind of a pleasure to have a jacket that's got all five authors on it.
Senator Bach, this bill isn't a precursor to taxing attorney's fees. Well, you'll just have to check with the chair of the tax committee.
I don't know what May is going to bring, but I don't think April will bring that. But I think there is I think, a rather technical amendment, Madam Chair, that kind of gets the bill in shape that needs to be put on. This is the first stop for the bill.
Senator Marty would offer the A2 amendment. This is an author's amendment, and
I think originally there was two amendments, Madam Chair, but I think they've been worked into one.
Okay, so it's the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and the amendment's adopted. Okay, Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, when I met with the proponents of this bill back last summer, early fall, it appeared to me that we hadn't resolved all the issues around good faith, bad faith, that has been around the legislature for a few years, that really people in the business community hadn't had their issue resolved. And so what this bill does is provides for the opportunity where a business feels has had a claim denied relative to property or liability, that in the event they go to court and they prevail and they get awarded the payment that the court says they should have gotten in the first place, allows them to recover their attorney fees and reasonable attorney fees and costs. And I think that's kind of important, in that if they're really a year or 2 years later have had to go through a court battle, incur a bunch of costs to get there, and they end up getting what's owed to them under their insurance policy, they shouldn't have to have deducted from that cost of just having to get what was due to them. And then the other provision is, and I should say before I move on from the reasonable attorney's fees and costs, that 21 other states allow that same thing, the recovery of reasonable attorney fees. And then the other change in the bill is that when the policyholder prevails in court, it changes the interest rate that they're awarded up to 12%. 11 other states, including Wisconsin, have a 12% rate. And the argument there is, the insurance company was able to not have paid the money out and was earning interest on it during the period of time when the claim was not resolved. So it really just, if I think there's people that believe that 12% is the kind of rate of return that insurance companies shoot for. What it does is just passes that, what we consider probably, arguably, an average interest rate that insurance companies receive onto the policyholder. There are businesses, Madam Chair, large and small, that support the bill. I've got a list, if any committee members want to see it, of about 24 businesses. This has been a difficult issue for the state chamber. As most of you are aware, there are state chamber members on both sides of this issue. It's been a difficult issue for their lobbying team here at the Capitol to address. And just want to recognize four businesses that are in the audience, because all of us appreciate when we have real people that aren't lobbyists, constituents come around. They're from Apogee Enterprises, Vascular Solutions, Sir Modix, and RW Docs, and they all have representatives here today that would be available and be able to communicate to the committee members why they support the change. Madam Chair, that's what's in here. The bill needs to go to Judiciary. I think there's probably an amendment the committee, I heard, is thinking about considering, but that really concludes my remarks. I want to give ample opportunity to the testifiers on both sides and members. I've tried to stay out of the fray and let you gather information from both sides. There's strong opinions on both sides of this issue, and today is our day to find out how good a job both sides have done.
Okay. Senator Bach, yeah, I have Lisa Frenette. I don't know if that's the order. Want to go ahead?
Ms. Fernette is fine, Madam Chair.
Okay. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Lisa Fernette with the Builders Association of Minnesota. If I might offer real quickly, Senator Bach had 15 authors on a bill of ours last year, so he should feel comforted in getting more people on his bills. I'm
Madam
here.
Chair, I don't believe in clone bills. That was done without my knowledge.
Still 15 authors. I'm here to support Senator Bach's bill today, and the reason that we support the bill is that a general contractor has to purchase a general liability policy when they construct a new house or do any remodeling. And part of that general liability policy covers things like completed operations coverage. A couple of years ago, we passed mandatory completed operations coverages for all insurance policies sold here in the state of Minnesota for builders. And what that does is if there's a secondary damage to a house, say through water infiltration and the wood flooring is ruined, it would cover that. We find a lot of times that we can't get the insurance company. They'll either deny or they won't indemnify us. And then a homeowner will come through with a civil litigation suit, and they'll usually file breach of contract, negligence, and breach of warranty in order to get things recovered through their house and make themselves whole. In listening to a lot of testimony on warranty bills that have been heard this year, you'll hear consumers and homeowners get up and say that the insurance companies come up with their attorneys, and then a builder gets up with their attorney. And all the time that a builder comes up with an attorney, it is to make sure that their interests are being protected against the insurance companies, which we have a hard time with.
Okay.
That's it.
Who else would like to testify?
Madam Welcome. Chair and members, my name is Ann Archambault, and I'm here on behalf of ABC Companies. And I just want to give a little bit of history and background as to ABC Companies because it's important as it plays into this issue. We're a 30-year-old business, family-owned and operated. Business began in Faribault, and our headquarters are still in Faribault, Minnesota. For those who may not be familiar with that area, we're about 15 minutes south of actually Senator Dahl's district, Northfield. And currently, we employ approximately 100 people in Faribault, and the town is about 20,000 people. ABC is in the business of sales, service, financing, and leasing of highway motor coaches. Think big Greyhound buses. That's what we do. We also have currently the largest independent lease fleet of buses all over the country, about 1,300 units right now. Insurance. Our company is very passionate about insurance. It's the single most important aspect of what we do in the sale and lease of motor coaches. And what I mean by that is ABC, it's important to us as a business. It's important to our customers that they have available insurance. And it's also very important to the people who get on the motor coaches that there is insurance available to the riding public. As a brief little example, over the last 9 years that I've been with ABC, there have been multiple incidents where ABC has either been wrongly denied insurance coverage or significantly delayed by many, many months. Either way, whether it's a denial or a delay, ABC is severely burdened by that decision made by insurance companies. Some may say that this is not commonplace, but I'm here to say that in my 9 years of being at ABC, I have personally been involved with at least 4 to 5 coverage suits. And currently today, as I sit here, we have 2 disputes regarding coverage ongoing at the same time right now.
Ms. Archambault, have you considered changing insurance companies?
Madam Chair, if I may, it's not just ABC's insurance company. ABC is an additional insured on policies by our lessees. So oftentimes when there's an accident or a physical damage claim, we have to pursue that insurance agency. So it's not just ABC's insurance. It's also when we're included as additional insured.
So if there's an accident, somebody's leased a bus and there's an accident, and you are named insured, they've added you to the policy, is there ever a question of liability, of whose fault the accident was? Or Could that be some of the reason that you aren't getting paid right away?
Madam Chair, I can't speak. I'm not the general counsel, so I don't have detailed knowledge. But what I can say is that we're named as additional insured on both the physical damage piece and the liability piece of a lessee's insurance policy. The lessee is the one who's operating the coach and theoretically will be involved in an accident. ABC will commonly get involved in a suit, and there are instances in my years of being at ABC where the insurance company will come and say, you're named insured, you're additional insured, you're loss payee, but due to XYZ, whatever reason it may be, we're not going to cover you. Then ABC's insurance carrier has to come in and step in. And all the time, what we end up having to do is then initiate suits because we're not getting the cooperation that we need from that insurance carrier, from the lessee's insurance carrier, that they should have provided to us at the beginning.
Do you have anybody here, I don't know, Senator Bach, do you have anybody here to explain why the claim isn't being paid? I mean, I think it's one thing for us to hear half of the story. I'm not challenging anything you're saying other than I think it's only fair that we also hear why a claim may not be being paid. That it doesn't do, I think, the committee a whole lot of good to know that somebody's having trouble collecting an insurance payment. I mean, we've had, under the bad faith thing issue for the last couple of years, I mean, historically, we've had people come before us complaining that their insurance company didn't pay when their business burned, and then we found out that they set the fire themselves and they had committed arson. But they still, you know, came here and told us that one side of the story. If we had heard the other side, we might have, you know, put the issue, well, the issue finally is, you know, kind of to bed. But I just worry about hearing only one side. I'm not questioning that you have, that you're not telling us the truth. I just think we need the whole story. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I was just going to point out that without, you know, with regard to not hearing both sides, the bill would only apply in situations where the person prevailed in court. So if it turned out that they didn't have a valid claim to begin with, they wouldn't. The bill wouldn't apply. So
yeah, Senator Olson, I understand that. It's just difficult to know unless you can tell me where you've prevailed in court and haven't. You know, that's.
Madam Chair, my name is Liz Porter from St. Jude Medical, and I would just add that, you know, this bill doesn't prevent the carrier from asserting defenses and litigating. We're not stopping that. They have defenses. They have their positions. We have our coverage positions. This just evens the playing field. It's, as Senator Olson said, it's only if we prevail. And I'm sure that you will hear from the other folks from the insurance industry, and they can tell you, you know, the other side, so to speak. But I would just appreciate your hearing our concerns and our experiences, because it is a very, very significant problem.
And that point reminds me, Senator Bach, the effective date of this bill looks to me, would you consider that retroactive? It's on page 2, line 32, line 31 and 32. So it applies to a cause of action that's existing on the date. I don't know if anybody up here has any actions that are currently existing, but is it your intent, Senator Bach, Mr. Stang, wouldn't that be retroactive in a sense?
Madam Chair, maybe in a sense. It certainly is clearly meant to apply to any cause of action that actually exists on August 1st.
So if that cause of action exists today, this bill would cover that. I'm not sure the committee wants to go there, but the chair doesn't. Anyway, I just thought I'd point that out. Anyway, Ms. Porter, please feel free to
Well, I would thank you, Madam Chair. I would let Ann continue, or Ms. Archambault.
Okay,
if
I understand, we have a time limitation here.
I just have a couple more comments, okay. If I may. I do want to reiterate the fact that ABC does not undertake initiating a lawsuit lightly. It's not something we want to do, and we would only do so upon feeling like we were definitely wronged by a wrongful insurance denial. It's not something we do off the cuff, so to speak. Just two more points, if I may. All the time that we're expending substantial sums of money in attorney's fees in initiating and the coverage dispute, we're also having to incur substantial amounts of money in the underlying lawsuit at the same time. We're a mid-sized company, a small company in southern Minnesota who does not have the sums of money to be able to expend this kind of cost to make sure that ABC is around for the riding public, for our customers, for our employees. And if I may respectfully request your vote in favor on this bill in its entirety, unamended. Thank you.
You like the retroactive part?
Sorry.
You like the part that covers cases that are ongoing now?
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
I'll bet a lot of people would like us to do that. Okay. Ms. Porter?
Madam Chair, I would like to introduce Leon Endress. He will give you a few comments, and then I would like to give a few comments. I understand the time limitations, but I think this is very important.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Endress, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Leon Endress. I'm the CEO and owner of Endress Processing, a company that recycles waste food products in Rosemount, Minnesota, and Senator Chris Gerlach's district. What we do is we pick up waste food products from food manufacturers. We bring it back to our facility in Rosemount, process it, produce a registered animal feed ingredient that's registered and regulated by the Department of Agriculture. A lot of our customers are like General Mills, Kraft, Malt-O-Meal, that type of place that they have outdated waste or production waste, and we process that and make a feed ingredient that is usually sold to large poultry and hog integrators, Jennie-O, Golden Plump, mm-hmm. Smithfield Foods, that type of place. A lot of our customers like us because the majority of the stuff that we pick up and process would normally be going to landfill. Our business, we employ about 250 people in all of our locations. In Rosemount, we have about 90 people, and that includes our corporate office. In February 2008, we had a serious fire at our plant in Rosemount, Minnesota. That included business interruption and property damage. Throughout the past year, our insurer has repeatedly denied paying the claim, and not because of any question. I should say they didn't deny paying it. They delayed paying anything. For an example, our plant was fully operational at the end of June in 2008. At that point, we had they only gave us about 70% of our property coverage that we already had paid out of our pocket to get the plant running. So by the time the plant was operational, they only paid 70% of our property claim and nothing on the business interruption claim. And just a lot of the delay tactics. For an example, they said they weren't set up to do wire transfers. And that's not a big thing, but that's another 2 to 3 weeks in their process to delay the payment. And a relatively small company like ours, we're forced to carry the cost, for rebuilding the plant as well as our business interruption, our debt service, and everything else. And this insurance company wouldn't communicate with our banks even. And there was a default issue with our bank because of the fire. And because they wouldn't communicate with the bank, we ended up paying default interest rates throughout the summer of 2008. And that's a cost that we had to incur, and from what I understand, we're probably not going to be able to recover that from the insurance company. The other delay tactic they used was in December when they were trying to negotiate. We had everything settled except for about $3 million, and of that $3 million in December, they acknowledged that they owed us $1.5 million, and there was $1.5 million in dispute. They said they were only going to issue one more check, basically to hold $1.5 million that was in dispute as ransom for settling the whole claim. After some discussions with our attorney, we ended up getting them to pay $1.5 million that was undisputed, and now they won't budge on the other $1.5 million. And our only choice right now is to take them to court and litigate the situation. And once we start litigation, it's a distraction to our business. It's a cost that we're going to have to incur. And, you know, from what I understand, if we're successful in proving that they do owe us the money, it's costs that we're not going to be able to recover. And it's an issue, from what I understand, that, you know, just talking with other business owners, there's another company, our neighbor company, Spectro Alloys, had the same issue with an insurance claim they've been fighting for the last couple of years. Different insurance companies, same issue. Just delay tactic after delay tactic to try to hang on to our money and not pay us out, you know, the proceeds that are due under the policy. And, you know, like I said, the insurance company's holding all the cards, and our only choice is to litigate. And once litigation starts, that's another delay tactic for them. They can delay paying that final payment again with no cost to them for insurance or attorney's fees. You know, so I guess what I'm looking for is Senator Bach's bill. It feels like it puts the small business more on an even playing field with the insurance carriers. It helps bring them to the table to negotiate in good faith and try to resolve issues that are outstanding and settle the claim. The other thing I guess I should point out is, oddly enough, the insurance company we're dealing with is a subsidiary of AIG. This company, the subsidiary, is financially healthy, but during the same period is when you know, our taxpayers are funding a $144 billion bailout bill to AIG for you know, some of their issues while they're not paying their claims to policyholders like myself. So I guess, again, you know, I would like you to support this bill, you know, in its entirety, again, without amendments. And, you know, realistically, I think there's something seriously wrong if the small business owner, the policyholder in the state of Minnesota can't have some of the same benefits that that other states provide to some of their policyholders.
Okay, Mr. Andrews.
So thank you very much.
Thank you, and you've got like 4 minutes left here, Senator Bach, for the proponents, if that's...
Hi.
Yes, Ms. Porter.
Again, Madam Chair, my name is Liz Porter from St. Jude Medical, and I will be brief. I understand your point. There are different kinds of insurance companies. There are good insurance companies. There are other insurance companies that, you know, may use different tactics. But I want to emphasize that this bill, as Mr. Endres just said, is meant to put the policyholder on a more equal footing. The insurance carrier still allowed to make all their defenses legitimate defenses sometimes. And if they succeed, they succeed. And so I want to emphasize that this is really simply a way to put all sizes of businesses in Minnesota on an equal footing with their insurance carriers. I, as I mentioned, am from St. Jude Medical. We're, of course, a different size from these companies. But our focus and passion is making medical devices that save people's lives. We are, of course, located in Senator Marty's district. You know, even we make very strenuous and committed efforts to high-quality products, but in our litigation climate today, we need insurance. We purchase insurance. We pay the premiums. We expect our carriers to be there for us when we have an issue, and that has not been the case. We have been sued by insurance carriers 3 times since 96. In the first case, we had been sued in 2 class actions. We went to our carrier, notified them, cooperated, turned over lots of documents, shared information with them throughout the litigation. When we sought the coverage, they launched a 13-month investigation, again requesting the same documents they'd had throughout the underlying litigation. And after 13 months, they then denied coverage and then sued us. And then the tactic of some insurance companies is to delay and to issue burdensome, you know, discovery requests. So you litigate. And because there is no attorney's fee provision, they don't have any incentive to cooperate and to compromise and to come to the table and reduce those litigation costs for both parties and burdens on the court. It's a huge drain on company investments, and as a company based in Minnesota, we want to put our time and energy into employing more people in Minnesota, expanding our facilities, again, making those life-saving products. In the second case, we had a similar situation. We had a product recall. Again, we cooperated with the carrier, five layers of coverage covered the loss. The sixth layer at $50 million has flatly denied coverage, again sued us. So I would just urge your support of this bill. I would urge all the members to think and consider it carefully. It's very important. I also want to emphasize, not just for companies of our size, but companies of all a range of sizes, small, medium, large. And, you know, we want to do the things that we're set up to do, make products, sell buses, deliver people, make products. And we can't do that if we are constantly paying attorney's fees to get coverage, which we have paid for. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I'm going to turn the I'm sorry. Turn it back to Senator Bach.
About 10 seconds here. So I'll let one more person speak, I guess. And Senator Sparks is going to take over for a few minutes here.
Oh, Madam Chair, Mr. Muehlhausen is just here in the event the committee has any questions.
Any questions of the committee? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when you say that the insurance company sued you, do you mean that they filed like a declaratory judgment action to get out of providing the coverage, and then you had to defend that lawsuit in order to get the coverage?
Correct.
Ms. Porter?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Liz Porter from St. Jude Medical. And your answer is that's correct. Senator Olson.
Okay. Further discussion, committee. Let's bring up Ms. Turner. To the witness stand, please. Welcome to the committee.
Two sides to every story, Mr. Chairman. Here we go.
Yep. And I'll just remind, we want to hear the other side, obviously, but we do have some more bills on the agenda, so if we could kind of stay on task here, and hopefully we'd like to take a vote in the next 15 or 20 minutes. Ms. Turner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Beverly Turner, Travelers Insurance Company. There are three things I'd like to address in my testimony: cost, delay, and float. First of all, if you do decide to vote for this bill, you are increasing costs to our policyholders, simply put. I had my business folks take a look at this bill at the and there has been amendments, and I thank the author for the amendments. That's made it a little bit better. But the original bill and its scope, my business folks couldn't even price this bill because it was in the totality of the scope of the bill. It is goes so far beyond what any other state does. They said we simply can't put a price tag on it. And that's to a detriment of our policyholders, our business policyholders, to increase premium costs to provide for a windfall for others. The second point I'd like to address is delay. There are occasions when we have legitimate coverage disputes that have to be challenged and investigated in order to perform the due diligence that's necessary to be fair to all our policyholders. At Travelers, we pride ourselves on paying our claims in a timely manner, and we're motivated to pay those claims in a timely manner because from our data, we've found that the longer claims are pending, the more we end up paying for a variety of reasons. So we are motivated to pay our claims in a timely manner. The last point I want to address is float. There is none. Our investment return for 2008 was 3.1%. That is extremely below this 12% prejudgment interest rate that you're looking at in the bill. In 2007, our interest investment was 3.9%. And according to the industry, NAIC keeps records of the industry, PNC industry investment return. For the years 2005 through 2007, it was 4.4%. As you can see, we're a conservative company, so our investment return was even lower than the industry rate. So I would respectfully ask you to vote against the bill before you.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. Who's next? Just introduce yourself. Mr. Hickey?
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mike Hickey, appreciate you taking me out of order. I have a doctor's appointment that I can't miss. just wanted to share a few thoughts about the bill. With the National Federation of Independent Business, so we're the largest business groups in terms of entities with 13,000 members statewide and primarily all small businesses. We polled our members on this, and they are opposed to this. But just a couple thoughts off the top. A little surprised to see this bill come forward this year after what you all went through the last 2 years. We had quite a battle on bad faith, and I think in the end a pretty good compromise was reached. As you might remember, you can get an additional $250,000 of damages beyond the payout if you prove an insurance company denied you and acted in bad faith, and get $100,000 of attorney's fees under the 08 Act if you can meet that standard. And I thought this issue was kind of resolved. I know a lot of you spent a lot of time on it. But anyways, this bill is before us. I appreciate the fact that probably the most controversial provision has been dropped, the consequential damages, by Senator Bach, and that is the House language. Also, I think that really gave this bill an unknown or runaway factor. When people are trying to project future damages, can anybody really answer what that means? And I think the reason our members are against this bill is that this bill would help the rare small business who has a very complicated or unusual claim against an insurance company. But most of our members don't have complicated insurance arrangements. They probably have one carrier. They probably have a pretty straightforward arrangement. And they know that if you're offering these kind of large volume damages, someone's going to pay for it. And the fear is that it's going to be the rest of the policyholders who aren't going to be in one of these kind of complex and potentially expensive claims. The two states that did something similar to this, not exactly what this is, but something similar, had very high increases. They had unlimited damages. They had unlimited attorney's fees. And I don't know if an amendment's coming up today or not. We heard there might be one to basically drop most of the bill, but advance a higher rate of return for businesses on prejudgment interest. When they have a dispute with an insurance company, that might be a good compromise, and we would encourage you to take a look at that. But I appreciate you giving me a few minutes to share our thoughts in opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Welcome, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dale Thorns, Joe. I appreciate the opportunity to spend a couple of minutes to talk to you about the bill. I'm an attorney in private practice in the Twin Cities area that has focused on insurance coverage issues over the last 20 years. I am here as a member of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association, where I have been a past chair of its Toxic Tort and Environmental Law Committee, founding co-chair and current member of its Insurance Law Committee, and I'm a member of its Law Improvement Committee. And it's in that basis, as a member of the Law Improvement Committee, that I testify here today. It's key for you to understand that the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association is an association that furthers the interests of the defense bar in general. That includes small and medium and large businesses, and specifically it is not an arm of the insurance industry. There are some key points about this law and the unintended results that this bill will end up having, especially in light of how you compare this with matters around the country. I have prepared a 50-state summary of the various remedies that were involved with the bill, and it provides some very interesting insights. In the totality, the remedies that are involved with this bill go far beyond what any jurisdiction in the country, except for one, provides for the remedies involved given how the bill is written. It is full of economic shortcomings, which essentially will turn a coverage litigation into an issue of what policyholder counsel can recover, not under the policy itself, but what can be recovered over and above the policy. In essence, it will create a situation where the tail will wag the dog, where the attorney's fees generated will only get more attorney's fees to be generated as opposed to what is being sought in the way of coverage. It, in essence, creates a presumption that any position raised by any policyholder is always presumed to be correct, and every position raised by every insurance carrier is always presumed to be incorrect. And that type of presumption just runs counter to the concept of the American system and the American rule, which is each side pays its own attorney's fees. In essence, it creates an unreasonable disincentive for legitimately contracting parties with good faith reason to dispute a position of another to assert their rights. And obviously, as you may recall, last year we did pass the bad faith bill. But let me specifically point to a particular factor about why this is extreme around the country. As I stated, I have prepared a 50-state summary of this legislation and the kind of remedies that are involved. Only the state of Idaho provides for a remedy that is of the same that is being addressed here in this bill, a 12% rate of recovery and an undiscretionary award of attorney's fees not based upon any type of bad faith conduct. Now, you heard Senator Bach discuss a couple of numbers as to number of jurisdictions which have prejudgment interest at 10% or more, and I believe he stated 21. I'm not going to quibble with that, but what the key point is we have a cocktail of remedies that are involved with this bill, and that is not only prejudgment interest, but also the award of attorney's fees. Senator Bach also referenced that, he referenced 21 other states have award for attorney's fees, 11 states have 12% or more for prejudgment rate of return. In fact, none of those states interact with each other for the cumulative remedies that are being sought in this bill, except for the state of Idaho. Therefore, this bill really stands at the far fringes of remedies that would be provided without some kind of a showing of bad faith. The other key aspect regarding this bill is the economic disincentive that that is created by this legislation. The key point with this bill is that the unintended consequence is going to be that it will encourage litigation as a first resort to address a coverage dispute, as opposed to a last resort, because this will only award attorney's fees if there is a commencement of a lawsuit. As well, it is reinforced by the fact that the language in Subdivision 2 addresses a problem where not only is there a denial, but also a failure to fulfill or a delay in fulfilling. And what those terms do, as we have seen in the state of Washington in the recent past, is create a situation where there is going to be litigation for the sake of litigation, as opposed to looking at how to address the coverage issue and resolve the coverage issue. In essence, it will be a race to the courthouse. It will be an increase in the judicial resources that will be required for coverage action as compared to what there has been in the past. Again, it's an automatic recovery as opposed to some type of a bad faith recovery, which is what the bill last year was addressing. And let me make a couple of points about the comments that were made by the bill's proponents. There are remedies available to a policyholder if, in fact, there is frivolous litigation or if there is oppressive discovery responses which are being – or discovery that is being sought. And those come in the sanctions provided by the court under Civil Rules 11 and 37. In fact, Rule 37 is a very good example of what does work when there is abuse of the discovery procedures. One of the presenting parties talked about oppressive discovery and oppressive requirements to respond to discovery, and yet that same presenter also was recently sanctioned by the court for $5,300 for failure to provide the discovery that was required by the court and was considered legitimate. So the sanction rule actually works in litigation in order to make the parties present what needs to be presented in order to resolve the discovery issue. The last point that I'd like to just briefly reference is the bill itself is set up for Chapter 68. There's some technical flaws with how this bill is set up. That's the insurance powers statute. As you may recall, the bad faith statute last year was dealt with under a different statute. And there may well be a conflict in putting this bill into Chapter 68 as opposed to putting it into the chapter in which the first party bad faith bill was installed. Finally, just one more comment about two of the presenters up here. They both talked about first-party property claims, and both of these entities, Minnesota companies, smaller Minnesota companies than the Fortune 500 companies, talked about issues involving additional insured issues or dealing with fire losses. We know that the fire loss was at the Dakota County facility for Endress processing. The key about that, members of the committee, is that the first party bad faith bill, if in fact there was a bad faith delay or denial, would address the remedies that are being sought. And so, in essence, what's being asked for with this bill would be a double recovery for the attorney's fees if in fact this was passed, and it's passed as a pending matter, so that it would affect matters pending as of August 1. The second one, members of the committee, comes from a company that operates in five states and operates all over the country. And I can tell you I've done a search for litigation involving ABC bus companies in the state of Minnesota. I have not been able to find any, which raises in my mind whether or not the law of Minnesota would apply to those additional insured issues that has been brought before the committee today. In fact, it may well be jurisdictions other than the state of Minnesota, and their substantive law would apply. And so this bill would not be a remedy that would be available in those situations. In closing, I thank you for the opportunity to discuss this with you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. I just wanted to remind people that we do have four additional bills on the agenda. And actually, at this time, just to make sure we can hear some testimony, I'd like to bring up Tom Hesse from the chamber, please. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And as Senator Bach mentioned earlier, this has put us in an interesting position, having members on both sides. So what we did beginning in December was convene the proponents and opponents of the legislation to a series of three meetings to hopefully try to reach some consensus around this issue. Well, we were unsuccessful in doing that, and really our board was interested in trying to find a solution that they could support. So at the staff level, we developed a policy that was then adopted by our board in February, which would just change the prejudgment interest rate from for commercial coverage disputes from the current law, which is the greater of 4% or the one-year constant maturity treasury rate, which, again, whichever is greater, to the greater of 4% or that one-year constant maturity treasury rate plus 3. So have a 3% bump in the prejudgment rate for these commercial coverage disputes. Our board did not support adopting the attorney fee provision or the consequential damage provision. So that was our board's attempt at finding some level of compromise on this issue. And the reason that the specific rate in question was chosen is looking at some of the 50-state analysis. There's only one other state that uses this constant maturity treasury rate as the base for its prejudgment interest rate, and they have a 3% add-on. So to be consistent with that state, which is Maine, our policy reflects that. And also the board thought, and I thought, it was important to continue to vary rates with the economic conditions. So I built off of Minnesota's existing statute with respect to prejudgment rates. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hesse.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to offer an amendment. And I hadn't prepared to do this. I'm filling it in as I look, but it's based on some of what Mr. Hesse has just described. And I think represents a really positive compromise. As Mr. Thornshow reminded us, we did do the bad faith. Now, I understand it doesn't apply in liability, but it would apply where there's property damage. And so some of the situation, or one of the situations we just heard about here today, would definitely have, and I suspect even maybe the bus company, that might not have been liability, it might have been property, and I don't know, but that if there were bad faith, and as Mr. Thornshow pointed out, this bill doesn't require the bad faith element, it's just a one-way loser pays, and you know, we're I don't think we want to go that way, so I'm going to offer this amendment. It's the A3. I move it, and I'll tell you what it does.
Did you get Senator Bach?
Does everybody? Oh, just make sure Senator Bach gets the amendment. Wait a moment. And I don't know, Mr. Hesse, perhaps you can explain constant maturity treasury rate, because that's not a term with which I'm familiar, but I think that the prejudgment interest probably should be increased from what we currently, I guess, have. So this would talk about that interest. It takes away the damages. It takes away attorney's fees and all those other costs, okay? But it says if you an insured who prevails would be entitled to interest the greater of 4% or the one-year constant maturity treasury rate plus 3%. I don't know if that – well, I'm not sure what that is today. I may have seen that maybe today is that 7 would be it would be 7% if that were today, I guess. And Mr. Hesse, maybe you can comment on that, and then I'll explain the rest of the amendment.
Mr. Hesse.
Madam Chair and member, or Mr. Chair and members, the current constant maturity treasury rate, I think, is somewhere around 0.5%. So with a 3% add-on, you would still be at the 4% floor under this proposal. It would only, once the rate gets above 1%, would there be a, would it start escalating beyond the 4% floor?
Okay. So that wouldn't be 7% today?
Mr. Hesse.
Mr. Chair, it would not.
Interest rates. We're in a world of hurt, aren't we? Well, I think that this amendment represents a compromise because, as Mr. Hesse says, the organization, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, represents large and small businesses, and they insurance companies and some of the companies that were represented up here today testifying in favor, and I think that it's important that we and respect what industry itself has worked out. So I'm offering this amendment, and then what we do is we take out all those other fees, we delete subdivision 4 and 5, and you go down to line 29 on page 2, application. Forgive me, no, effective date, line 31. We would change. So effective date, it says this section is effective August 1, 2009, and applies to a cause of action, and I would take out existing on or. So it would say applies to a cause of action arising on or after that date. So we don't have an impact on any causes of action that have arisen before. So with that, I just would ask the committee to support that. And
Senator Olson to the amendment, and Senator Bach. Senator Bach, maybe first.
Yeah.
Senator Scheid, I appreciate your effort, except under the new amended interest language, it's this year it's the same thing as current law. It's still, because the treasury rate's 0.5%, you still, even at 3% over that, you still don't get the interest rate high enough to meet the current floor. So it doesn't change anything in current law right now relative to the interest rate. But I realize these are pretty extraordinary interest rate times. I'm pretty surprised with those kind of interest rates that banks still refuse to loan money. But members, I don't have, maybe I was the wrong author for the bill, because I don't have a lot of time between now and May 18th to kind of hammer this out. I would rather not amend it to water it down, just to get it out of here and move it along, because, I don't know what the status is in the House. I think it's on the floor. I don't have time to spend a lot of time in conference committee. I'd rather know, let's just take a vote, and the bill fails, I'll go back to the tax committee and get to work. If it passes, I'll go to judiciary, I guess. But no, it's not going to death. There's enough coming there.
Thank you. Senator Olson, to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just have to say that you know, especially in terms of any relief today, as Senator Bach pointed out, this essentially just eliminates the bill if we were to accept this motion. And I know we have other bills to consider, but so many points were made by Mr. Thorns, Joe, that I think, from my perspective at least, seemed a bit misleading. For example, talking about encouraging litigation, I would have to say that just having this remedy available, just like any remedy at the end of the road, is what negotiations are all about. And so it's not going to add or subtract from any likelihood of negotiation, except to the fact that insurance companies are not likely to put up defenses that they know are not likely to be upheld by the courts. And there's a big difference between the standard for frivolous and the standard of that attorneys know in terms of whether you have an actual legitimate defense or not. So that's something that would be considered in terms of making sure that only really valid denials of insurance coverage are put forward, because right now there really isn't a penalty when that happens for anyone except the person who's taking out the policy. I look at what this does is really just an attempt to make the person who purchased the policy whole, because there are two things they're going to lose. One would be the value of the money that they that's delayed or withheld, and the other is the attorney's fees that they would have to pay. I would also say that the attorney's fees are not automatic. Not only do they not have to win the claim, but then it says reasonable attorney's fees, and certainly if someone's been awarded attorney's fees under one section, the court isn't going to award them because it is in the court's discretion under another section. That would not be reasonable. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to request a roll call vote.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to change the I'm just going to do this, and this is kind of on the fly, but I'm going to say just 7% flat. 7%, not the greater of, but 7%, and for the interest. So it would say 7% per annum interest instead of the greater of. Does that, Mr. Stang, does that work that way?
Madam Chair, on line 7, page 2, line 7 of the bill, you delete 12 and insert 7. That would replace the language of the A3 amendment on lines 7 and 8, and everything else I think would stay the same.
Okay. Senator Johnson, to the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, to the amendment. Senator Scheid, I agree with you. I heard explicitly what Mr. Thorns Joe said about overlap of what we did last year and this currently. So I think I like what you're doing on the fly. Let's change the percentage and let's change the last language as far as the effective. And then I think it's good.
So, Senator Olson, we need to take a vote. Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I would just say that, you know, in terms of the effective date, that's one area where I think that, you know, that some work could be done on the bill to make it comply more with what we normally would do. But otherwise, I would not support the amendment just because I think it otherwise kind of guts the bill. So, okay. Again, roll call.
Yeah. Roll call has been requested. Senator Scheid moves the A3 amendment. We'll incorporate the oral amendment. A roll call has been requested.
Scheid?
Yes.
Dahl?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Marty?
No.
Metzen?
Yes.
Olson?
No.
Scogan?
Yes.
Sparks?
No.
Vandeveer?
I don't think he said yes.
Yes.
On a 5-4 vote, the motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 528 as amended be, I'll say recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Further discussion? Mr. Senator Bach.
Just I just want the committee to know I suspect the Judiciary Committee is likely to take another look at that attorney fee provision. And if this committee, I guess, wants to see it back at that point, then I think we need to know that. But, I mean, I don't think, I mean, let's nobody think that they're not going to want to take another look at that.
Senator Shy.
Mr. Chairman, no, Senator Bach, and you and I had that conversation, and I understand, and no, I won't ask for it back as chair, so no. I think the committee's had a good discussion and heard, you know, a lot of testimony, so.
Okay, Senator Shy renews her motion that Senate File 528 is amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr.
Bach.
Chairman of the committee.
And Senator Sparks.
He was going to go with you. He was sticking with you.
Never sticks with
you. You were sticking with me.
Pardon me?
Oh, no. Senator Bach, thank you for your patience
with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for all your time.
Okay. Senator Sparks has someone here from out of town. Does anybody else have someone from out of town? So, does anybody else, Senator Scogin or Senator Olson, do you have anybody from out of town? I think, well, Senator Olson does. There's somebody here.
I don't know if that's.
Madam Chair, thank you
Senator
very much
Sparks,
for
yes.
moving around and allowing us to hear Senate File 1611.
Yes.
In the interest of time, I'm going to turn over to my witness, who actually is headed to Bemidji after this, so maybe Senator Olson could give him the most direct route.
I can.
With that, I'll turn over to my witness.
Yes, Senator Sparks, welcome to our committee.
Madam Chair, Senator Sparks, thank you, and members of the committee. My name is Mike Frenchu, and I represent the Minnesota Nonprofit Employers Workers' Compensation Fund. And in the interest of condensing things for time, I'll cut my statement short. The Minnesota Nonprofit Employers Workers' Compensation Fund is an organization that was organized in 1995 and currently has 149 member organizations. And the organization insures some $458 million in payroll estimated for 2009. So it's a pretty substantial operation. What we are asking for is, and one of the problems that exists.
If someone has a cell phone on, that's probably causing that very annoying noise.
Madam Chair, maybe that happened for a reason. I do also have an author's amendment that I need.
Whatever it takes, Senator Sparks, to trigger our
it's
amendment.
The
A1 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair.
And there's an author's amendment on that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. And I see you're reinstating stricken language on page 1. So up on line 9 and 10, that language would be reinstated.
That's correct.
Okay.
Madam Chair, yes, the language, the League of Minnesota Cities, after our House committee requested, we put that language back in. So we didn't have a problem. It didn't affect us at all.
Okay.
So. But anyway, what we're really looking for here is under current law in Minnesota for a self-insured group workers' compensation fund, we're barred from incorporating. And so subsequently, the entity that this nonprofit the fund ends up being a taxable entity, and so subsequently the members of the fund generate anywhere from 60% to 90% of their revenue from funding from the state of Minnesota through programs for group homes, for developmentally disabled adults, community rehabilitation facilities, and mental health centers. And so what happens is that those funds go to the organizations, they turn around and they pay a premium into the workers' compensation fund, and we in turn have to pay about $250,000 a year on the average in federal income tax, so we're sending the money to the federal.
So you're saying you're effectively, well, in large part, creatures of the state almost, along with these other political subdivisions. I think I understand this.
Madam Chair, that's correct, yes. And so what we're looking for is the ability to form a trust similar to the League of Minnesota Cities Trust, the Minnesota Counties Trust Program, the Minnesota Township Program. There is already several areas of gray language in the bill, or not necessarily in this law, but in others.
What language did you say?
In language in other laws that talk about different types of nonprofit organizations are already considered a political subdivision. All we're saying is in this bill we'd like to There in this law, we'd like to clean up the language and just say nonprofit organizations.
Okay. Is there anybody? Well, Senator Olson, you have a question. I'm going to ask if there's anybody in the audience, or is anybody from the department who would want to say something about this? Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I have two questions, and maybe they're not any reason for concern, but I just want to bring them up.
No,
just
Senator
to
Olson,
make sure.
That's fine.
One is that, you know, our HMOs in the state are nonprofit, and are we clear that we're not going to make this private insurance that would be considered a nonprofit falling under this? Maybe that's not any reason. Maybe it's clear enough, but I just want to make sure that that isn't an issue. And then I also want to make sure that we're just talking about tax-exempt status and that we're not self-insured pools in general that fall under ERISA are not subject to Fair Claims Practice, the Fair Claims Practices Act, which governs how they have to behave, and that's a consumer protection law. And I would just want to make sure that if they're already subject to that, that we're not extending that exemption to any farther than we already have it in terms of making sure that we have as much consumer protection in place as we can, except where we're preempted by the federal government.
I'm wondering who's incorporated under Chapter 317A. Is that the clue here for us? Or
well, that is the Madam Chair, that actually is the clue here. They're incorporated under 317A in the state of Minnesota as a nonprofit corporation. And then also, if I may address one of Senator Olson's questions.
Yes, Mr. Frenchman.
The ERISA guidelines don't really follow workers' compensation. They are for health insurance. And so we don't enter into that arena in any way. The last thing I also wanted to point out is one of the questions that had come up was in relation to your first question. Yes, we're not attempting to try and take this and have it become something else of a public entity. All we're doing is we're trying to form this trust as a corporation so we can apply for not-for-profit status.
So it strikes me that I think Senator Olson's question is a good question, though. Maybe something we need to be concerned about. So I'm not sure of that. Maybe Mr. Gross, you can help us with that. But Senator Sparks, anyway, that's not your intent, right?
Certainly
it's literally
not, Madam
to
Chair.
Cover just this. So we may have to be more specific. I don't know. I think we can work on. That's the sort of thing, as long as we have the understanding. And Senator Metzen agrees with me 100%. I can tell you.
No, I was just falling asleep.
Almost.
Oh, I was very.
I thought you were nodding yes. You were nodding off.
Well, yeah, let's call it that.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen is a co-author, so he likes this idea.
It's got to be good, though.
You're from the department.
So, Mr. Gross, welcome.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Gross. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Commerce. We just got wind of this bill, and so we're looking at it. I've had some conversations here with Mike, and Mike and I are going to meet later this week. So we're trying to just get a better understanding what this bill is trying to accomplish. I think the only concern we have is just to make sure that whatever is being pursued here is somewhat, in a sense, under the some disguise of being regulated and making sure it's correct. But we need to get more information, and we're going to seek that later this week.
And there may be a more artful way to say it in the language of the bill or something, if that's possible. I think I feel comfortable with that. And I thank Senator Olson for raising the question. And Mr. Gross, yes.
I'm just hoping Mike gets back because it's snowing up north. And you know, who knows?
That's right. Not here yet, though, no. Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to speak to this? Then understanding that you're going to be continuing to do some work, but Senator Sparks, I think I hope the members feel we dare let you out of the committee with the bill. So Senator Sparks moves that Senate File 1611 as amended be recommended to pass. And I don't think it has to go anyplace else. So we'll probably see an amendment on the floor then, Senator Sparks. But I think we agree with what you want to do. I hope the members do. And
well, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Olson.
I have one question then. Would
yes,
this
of
be
course.
Would this be putting existing law, or would this be taking money out of our Senator Bach's tax committee, and is that going to need a fiscal note?
Mr. Frenchough.
Madam Chair, no, this is a zero-cost bill to Minnesota. As a matter of fact, ideally what we're attempting to do is, because of the funding cuts these organizations are bound to see with this in this session, we're trying to come up with a way to offset a few of their expenses. And so subsequently we can do and write their insurance a little bit less of a price for them. It'll save them expenses.
Just don't anybody tell President Obama. So on the Sparks motion that 1611 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Mr. Frenchough, thank you.
Thank you, member.
Senator Scogin. Okay, Senator Olson. Go ahead.
Okay.
Senator Olson. Senator Scogin, do you have anybody for either? I see Mr. Sposetto for one of them, but he's local.
He's not
a local guy. No.
A domino?
He's from out of this world.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 842 is a bill that will ensure that the relationships in the Minnesota auto repair marketplace remain as they are today. The current marketplace involves a three-party relationship between the consumer, the insurance company, and an independent repair shop. The bill before you would prohibit insurance companies from also becoming the repairer of the vehicle. For the most part, the insurance industry is not looking to get into the repair business. However, some insurers have tried to move in this direction, are doing that in other states, not in Minnesota today. But some of the insurance companies we have in Minnesota have done this in other states. And concerns arise over the financial pressures that can be brought to bear on the repair process. The entity paying for the repairs is the same entity that is carrying out the repairs. Insurance-owned shops shift control in the repair process to the hands of insurance companies who have a vested interest in limiting the scope and cost of the repairs. This bill maintains the checks and balances in our current system today in Minnesota in the repair market, minimizes incentives to cut corners in the repair process. Mr. Chita is here today from the automotive repair industry to speak on behalf of the bill in detail.
Mr. Chita, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. My name is Bruce Chita. I own Lake Marion Collision in Lakeville and currently serve as the Alliance of Automotive Service Providers President. I've been in the repair industry for 26 years. I've owned Lake Marion Collision for the past 12. I want to thank Senator Olson for authoring the bill before you today. The legislation is a product of much discussion among the automotive repair industry, and I'd like to tell you why the 600-plus members of the AASP Minnesota so strongly support this proposal. Senate File 842 would prohibit insurance companies from owning repair shops. Our analysis has convinced us that the vertical integration of the repair industry is not in the best interest of the consumers and not in the interest of the independent repair shops. By law, consumers are entitled to have their vehicle completely and safely repaired to its pre-accident condition. However, a conflict of interest arises when the insurance company that's paying for the repair also performs the repair. Whether it's properly identifying all hidden damage, selecting the most appropriate replacement part, or performing the manufacturer's recommended repair procedures. The independent collision repair industry has the training and the technical expertise to ensure that the vehicle is restored to its pre-accident condition and the customer is satisfied. Frankly, most insurers are interested in the same thing. However, there can be circumstances where the insurance company seeking to save money may be less inclined to have its in-house repair facility be as thorough in the search for needed repairs. And there have been instances where insurers, even in the current market, have pressured independent shops to use parts that do not meet the standards guaranteed to Minnesota consumers in state law. Left unchecked, an insurer's desire to save money and pursue the lowest cost of repair can easily jeopardize the integrity and safety of the repair. Another concern is that the insurer-owned shops may ultimately result in consumers having fewer choices for automotive repair. Insurers are more likely to aggressively steer their insureds to their own shops and away from independent shops. Steering significantly undermines fair and healthy competition in the marketplace based on services and quality of repair. And less competition almost always results in higher prices. AASP Minnesota drafted this proposal for consideration more than 4 years ago. At the time, other states were considering this legislation, and the state of Texas passed a bill prohibiting insurer-owned repair shops. That legislation was subsequently challenged in federal court and, after several years, ultimately upheld. With all of our federal court challenges behind us, we now wanted to bring this bill forward in order to maintain the balance which currently exists in the repair market, a balance that has consumers, independent repair shops, and insurers all continuing their respective roles in a market that works well for all interests in most circumstances. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today, and I will respond to any questions.
Mr. Cheetah, thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify here? We're going to move along. Mr. Pike, I'm sorry, and is it Ms. Mazanak?
Yes.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
I think you want to leave town, right?
We never want to leave, but my son did insist that I get home in time to tuck him in this evening.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Pike. I'm Allstate's counsel for the Midwest region. And with me is Sharon Masonic, who represents Sterling Auto Body, and she comes via Texas. So thank you very much for giving us the time.
Okay.
Very briefly, Allstate Insurance Company believes strongly in market innovation that improves the customer experience and increases competition. To that end, Allstate is constantly seeking to expand customer choice in their auto repair options, improve the quality of repair work paid for through the Allstate claims process, and decrease the repair time so consumers are put in their cars more quickly. The reason for this is simple. The better the claims experience, the more likely the consumer is to renew with Allstate, consider Allstate in the future if they're insured by another carrier, and refer Allstate to a friend. I mean, simply put, the claim is our opportunity to show that we can fulfill on our obligation to our consumer and our primary concern and purpose during that process to ensure that we do an excellent job providing the customer with the service that they expect with the least amount of hassle. An example of the effort to use innovation to improve the customer experience through innovation was the acquisition of Sterling Auto Body Centers by the Allstate Non-Insurance Holding Company in 2001. Allstate's Non-Insurance Holding Company acquired Sterling as part of an ongoing effort to increase customer choice with a differentiated customer experience, superior claim service, and guaranteed quality repairs. The prohibitions in Senate File 842 stifle such innovation, limit customer choice, and harm the consumer as a result. Now, before I yield to Ms. Mazanek from Sterling, I would like to address issues about as it relates to Allstate's claim referral process. Simply put, Allstate does not steer auto repair work for two simple reasons. Our research shows that customers want the freedom to choose and do not want to feel like the insured is hijacking them in their choice or hectoring them to choose a specific auto body shop. And number two, it's against the law. So I do want to also point out that when we do have a claims process and when someone calls and asks Allstate to address the repair of their vehicle, during the scripting, as we call it, and is it consistent with the anti-steering laws that were put in place in Minnesota in recent years, simply put, if the consumer has an auto body shop of their choice that they would like to have their vehicle repaired at, it's the end of the story as it relates to our providing them guidance on their options for auto repair. We simply send a tech out or have them provide us an estimate, and we adjust it thusly. However, if the consumer does not have a shop of their choosing or is not familiar with shops in their area, we do provide them information about shops that are either involved in our direct repair program, like all other insurers, or if there's a marketplace where a Sterling shop exists, we will provide them information about that option as well, all done under full disclosure of the relationship between Allstate and Sterling or the nature of the relationship between Allstate and the direct repair facility. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have this, Mr. Pike, does Allstate have own any other Are you in other states, I guess is what I want to say. Is it just in Texas, or is it Sterling is in other locations?
No, Madam Chair, that is correct. And Sharon will speak to the states in which we're doing business and the number of shops that Sterling has. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'm not sure how to say your name, so.
Mazonic. Hi, my name is Sharon Mazonic. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sharon Mazonic. I am from Texas, and I'm a 24-year veteran of the collision repair industry, with about the last seven of those when I joined Sterling in 2002. And Sterling was founded in 1997. It is a division of Alcorp. They acquired us in May of 2001, and that's something that Sterling employees are really proud of. We don't hide from the fact that we're owned by Alcorp. We're an affiliate of Allstate Insurance. We clearly disclose it to any of our customers that come in on the authorization forms that they sign, and through working through just in everything that we do. We even have them posted on our counters that we're an Allstate subsidiary. So, again, that's something that we're real proud of. We don't hide from it. We have 61 locations in 16 states. Last year, we repaired in excess of 73,000 vehicles. Our home office is actually in Natick, Massachusetts, in our store support center. We do operate. I'm Vice President of Marketing, Sales, Real Estate, and Construction. So we are a very lean team, but we have our own leadership team, our own board of directors. We answer to a different profit and loss statement. So we are at arm's length within Allstate Insurance as an Allstate affiliate, just to make that clear. We have about 1,100 employees, slightly over that now, with a great diversity mix. About 48.8% of those are considered minorities. And all of our technicians, all of our Sterling locations have achieved the ICAR Gold status, which is industry recognized. It kind of goes to speak to when he was talking about, or some of the opposition was talking about skilled trained technicians and certified estimators. We have all that. So, again, all of our locations ICAR Gold certified. Our genesis was to make a bad situation great by ensuring the best in class customer service, quality, and cycle time. And today, after our years of operation, we've repaired over 750,000 vehicles. It still holds true today with our award-winning customer service that, again, industry recognized with, and 9 out of 10 of our customers would gladly refer Sterling to a family member or friend. We've done so by a unique production process, by building inline quality checks. We go through 7 different quality checks throughout the course of our repair. We have independent estimators that are Sterling employees that write the repair plan that's best to repair each and individual vehicle. So it's taken on a one-on-one vehicle. There's not someone here from different insurance companies saying, you must do this, you must do that. We make that initial repair plan. And also great customer interaction. We also, each time vehicle goes through the quality checks, we also inform our customer of the progress or the process milestone that it's just achieved. So they're well on top of everything and informed in everything we do. We not only do repairs for Allstate, but we also are direct repair programs for 30 other insurance companies or fleet partners. Last year, we serviced over 180 different companies. So that's kind of a misnomer that's out there that I'd like just to kind of clear up real quickly. And we're basically here today to protect our opportunity to grow. In Texas, where I'm from, the only state where similar legislation was passed, it was passed with a split decision. And our competitors, freedom of speech was actually, we won, and the opposition won the commerce part of it. So if you want to say win-lose. So it was a split decision after months and actually years of appeal. And our competitors, some of the original opposition that brought this to our Texas legislation that said they were going to be stifled with growth, have been allowed to grow. In fact, since then, they've opened 5 new locations since the legislation has passed in marketplaces that they weren't in. And we're not allowed that same opportunity. Our customers aren't allowed that same opportunity to have a Sterling present in their market. So we think it actually limits growth and opportunity.
Ms. Mazonic, I don't mean to cut you off because I know you've come a long way. Want to ask you if you deal with the no steering, the steering prohibition in Texas that we do here.
There is anti-steering legislation that is in effect in Texas as well.
It's absolutely in statute. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. So I guess to just kind of wrap it up real quick, our growth plans are currently limited to states where our customers are asking us to be, so it's pretty much in markets that we're already in. Sterling makes that decision. Allstate doesn't make that decision for us, but Sterling does. They make that decision by consulting with all of our different business partners, those 30 different companies that we're currently doing business with and where our stores are currently over demand. So we constantly are telling customers, we can't fix your car today, and we want to be able to fix it today. And in the event that we did decide to come to this market, we would definitely, as a matter of respect, give you a heads up, give our opposition or the local state associations here a heads up, and let you know that our position has changed. But currently, we have no plans to come to this marketplace. We do, our stores do have question?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
No.
I'm sorry. So, again, no current plans. So we're just here to state our opposition, hopefully protect our opportunity to grow if this does become viable. Place. Legislation has been introduced in many states, but only in Texas has it passed.
So, Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to put that a little bit in context and wanted to appreciate the information Mr. Cheetah has given me. Basically, what Texas did was they were the first state to pass this legislation, and then, as Mr. Cheetah said, there were court challenges that put this in limbo, but in the place where they were, I'm under the understanding that so far Allstate is the only insurance company that's actually doing that. This, and I assume that's probably
across,
why.
I'm sorry, across the United States. Yeah.
Sorry, you have to go through the chair.
Okay, but, Senator Olson, you're the Allstate's the only company,
right? And Madam Chair, the other states that are introducing legislation are doing it as Minnesota is. Since the court decision was made, so there have been at least 10 other states that have introduced legislation to limit this practice or prohibit this practice since that legislation since that court decision was reached. In Texas, what happened was the legislature decided not to allow any further expansion of these businesses, but the ones that were already there were allowed to continue. I would suggest that doing this now in Minnesota is timely because it's, as was said in the other body, it's really hard to put the genie back in the bottle. And so if we want to protect our existing status quo in the state before something would happen, this would be the way to do it.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Metzen.
Yeah, my look and see at this issue is that I think things are working pretty well today in Minnesota, and I think, as far as I know, that the it's a very competitive industry the way it is now, and things are working, and I think our rates are pretty fair on your repairs here. And I think the company up here, they're not interested in coming here, and nobody else is talking about it, and I think things are going good, so I support Senator Olson's initiative here.
Madam Senator Olson, I do too, but you're up against President Palmer, you know.
I do, Madam Chair, I do have an amendment which I believe the industry has asked for. The A1 amendment makes it clear that these are just, we're just passing the law that would be limited to businesses located in Minnesota. So, for example, we're not attempting to limit Allstate or any other insurance company from what they might do in another state, which I don't think we could do anyway, but this is just making that clear.
Wow. Senator Olson offers this amendment, and this is our first amendment, right, the A1 and offers amendment.
Thank you.
And it makes it more technically correct. Do you need a copy?
No, I have it, Madam Chair, and I'd like to offer this amendment. I was just responding to Senator Vandiver has another amendment, but I'm not quite sure if I understand it, so I don't know if he wants to offer it.
If it's one he shared with me, I probably.
Okay.
Let's move on.
So, on the Olson A1 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. So, Senator Vandiver, did you have an amendment?
Madam Chair, then I'd like to move Senate File 842. I don't think it goes anywhere else. Be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Aye.
And to the people from Allstate, I mean, Dennis Haysbert is a wonderful spokesperson. I'm trying to explain to my committee members that that's President Palmer from the TV show 24. And those of us, he'll always be President Palmer to me, even though he was killed in that series. So, but I know he is a great spokesperson.
Oh, boy.
And thank you.
It's good to know.
On the Olson motion that Senate File 842 as amended be recommended to pass, and it will go to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Thank you, everybody. We will be Mr. Cheetah, Mr. Pike, Ms. Mazanik. We have 8 bills on Thursday, members. So with this, I'm going to adjourn the meeting. But